From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch. A weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, we're going to focus on the tragic aftermath of the January 12th earthquake in Haiti. UN officials put the death toll at around 200,000, but that's just an estimate, and the real figure may never be known. 1.5 to 2 million people were left homeless by the quake that devastated the long-suffering nation, one of the poorest in the world. Among the first reporters to reach Haiti after the quake was NPR's Carrie Kahn. She filed this graphic account from the morgue in Port-au-Prince.
The city's one-story morgue is full. Authorities don't even try to get all the bodies inside the small building anymore. They just stack them out on the street. The line of corpses stretches to the end of the block, then snakes around the corners.
It's for the first time I see such a thing like that. So many people.
Serafin Rodriguez has come to the morgue with his brother, Efren Israel. They went inside trying to find their neighbor who died in the earthquake.
There are people all everywhere. If you're on that, you have to left your feet, first of all, to move.
You have to watch where you walk. You might step on
someone. Yep. Because everybody is all around the ground.
For the first time, we see this. It's like a dream. It's a nightmare.
The brothers say they have to find her and give their neighbor the dignified funeral that she deserves.
We live in a society. Each member in the society is very important for one of us. And we think that they are important for us too.
Dozens of friends and relatives outside the morgue have the same hope for a proper funeral for their loved ones. The crowd outside stand along the wall of a nearby building. It's the only patch of shade in the heat of the afternoon. Many say they are trying to prepare themselves emotionally before actually stepping inside. This is the second day that Guimon Sistabain has come looking for his parents. He speaks through a translator.
They come to us here. Each time they spend 1.5 hours to looking for him.
Sistabain says he won't go back in again until tomorrow. He just needs to rest first. As we are talking to him, a small crowd gathers around us, hoping we can offer some help. Paul Vasny shows us a picture of her older brother. She says he was selling shoes in a small stall on the downtown streets when the earthquake struck. A building fell down and crushed him. She says she's already been inside the morgue, but it was too hard to find him. She says the bodies are decomposing and people's faces have changed so much. Vivian says Louise shakes her head. She's here looking for her husband. She says she knows it will be difficult to go inside, but she's prepared to do anything to get his body out. Sis Louise says her husband was at work at the time of the quake and should be wearing his plastic-covered ID. She speaks through a translator.
His badge is only on the body. Yeah, with that one, it's more easier to her to find him.
The director of Port-au-Prince's main hospital, Dr. Alex Lasseg, says about 7,000 bodies have come through the morgue since Tuesday. He says he's doing the best he can to properly dispose of the cadavers. He says officials came last night and took many to a mass grave site that has been set up outside the capital.
It was about 1,000 last night.
1,000 last night.
Yeah.
Looks like you have 1,000 still there.
Yes. I call in order they could get them.
He says he's arranged for more trucks to come today. Relatives come up the street with whatever they can find sturdy enough to take away their loved one's body. One man shows up with a pickup truck with a wooden box in the back. Another comes to the morgue with just a wheelbarrow and a sheet. Abnier Antoine brought 6 men with him, many from a funeral home where he just bought a cream-colored casket for his daughter Belen. The men struggle to hold on to the large casket and get it inside a big truck at the end of the street. Antoine says his daughter was 25 and studying to be a teacher. She was at school in the classroom when the building collapsed. His eyes are full of pain and he looks exhausted. He says it's just too much devastation. The men place his daughter's coffin in the back of the truck and slide it all the way to the side. Antoine sighs. They then slide out another coffin from the truck, haul it out, and carry it back down the street past all the dead bodies and into the morgue. Antoine had to purchase 2 coffins. The other one is for his nephew, who also was studying at the school and died the day of the quake. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
NPR's Jason Beaubien watched rescue and recovery efforts outside the Hotel Montana, once among the best in the Haitian capital, but now completely destroyed.
Clear, ho!
Completely clear, everybody on.
More than 2.5 days after the quake struck, members of a search and rescue team from Fairfax County, Virginia, carried American Dan Woolley out of the wreckage of the Montana Hotel. Earlier in the morning, they'd plucked Haitian Lucien Mondessier from the massive pile of concrete. Woolley and Mondessier were trapped side by side in adjacent elevator cars. In the darkness, they talked and encouraged each other until the rescue teams arrived. When Woolley emerged, Mondessier, in his dust-covered bellhop uniform, was standing outside to greet him. And for the first time, they could see each other.
Hey, good to meet you, man. Get your address to someone for me, okay?
Okay.
All right. Okay, I want to talk with you. So good to meet you.
Woolley and Mondessier were deep in the wreckage at the bottom of two elevator shafts that had flipped on their sides. Mondessier said the darkness was terrifying and he'd started to hallucinate. He said he and Woolley encouraged each other throughout the ordeal. Woolley, who'd injured his leg, was whisked away to a clinic. Mondessier was walking around, posing for photos with the rescue workers and talking to the press. He said he and Woolley always believed that they'd be saved. The rescue crews worked throughout the night to try to reach at least 8 people believed to be alive in the remains of the hotel.
My name is Reinhard Riedel, and I'm married to Nadine Cardozo Riedel, the co-owner of Montana.
His wife, Nadine, he said, was one of the ones trapped. Riedel stood in front of a huge jutting slab of concrete that used to be the hotel roof, and he was waiting.
My wife's still alive. It was very uncertain this morning. And yesterday, all day long, they didn't know where she is, actually. So right now, I feel relieved, and everything else is secondary.
The search and rescue crews had to prop up parts of the wreckage to reach the pockets where people were still alive. Under Klieg lights, the team members burrowed in and out of the pile of concrete chunks. Sam Gray, who's a firefighter from Fairfax County, Virginia, was one of them.
It's quite a shock to go in through the dark and actually see somebody's hand poke out all of a sudden, which is normally the first thing you see. That's always a strange sight to see.
Gray says they'd been working for 3 days straight, and his team managed to pull 3 people out alive. But he says it's hard to savor these victories because there's so much destruction and death around them, even inside the wreckage.
There'd be bodies right next to the people that are alive, right next to, laying on top of, and you'll have one alive, one not alive. And of course, that has a pretty big impact.
All across the Haitian capital, buildings have collapsed, some completely, others partially. Search and rescue crews are trying to extract a group of people from inside a supermarket. After the quake, they'd made calls from their cell phones for help. With so many buildings collapsed and so many people missing, it's possible that thousands survived the quake but are trapped somewhere in the debris. Today, Reinhard Riedel gave up his vigil for his wife. He'd gotten word that despite his initial optimism, she'd apparently died in the collapse, and her body was still inside the hotel.
We might as well take 3-4 days to take out, because we have to take all the rubble away.
He's worried now that his wife might get dumped somewhere in a mass grave. Riedel has joined the thousands and thousands of Haitians in mourning for the loss of their loved ones. He was walking back to the hotel to try to make sure his wife's body is properly taken care of. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
NPR's Greg Allen reported from the main hospital in Port-au-Prince.
It's a chaotic scene at the General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. Patients who were being treated when the earthquake hit now line the streets and fill the park across from the hospital. They've been joined by people injured in the earthquake, many with terrible injuries and lying on the ground on blankets. Into that desperate scene today, several men came carrying a young woman, partially clothed and covered in dust. They lay her down gently on a wooden pallet under a tree. Dennis Bonney said she'd just been pulled from underneath her home's rubble.
They find her in the downtown. They hear her voice. She cried, help, 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 and they find her.
Her name is Roberta Joachim. She works at Haiti's National Library and appears to be in remarkably good shape. She's weak and dazed, probably dehydrated after 3.5 days trapped in her home's wreckage. She says her hand hurts and her back, but she's able to sit up and talk a little.
pendant sous cabane là me garder me senti tremblement de terre et puis me garder moi personne yop sous tomber me déplacer.
She was on the bed when the thing happened. But she doesn't understand what happened really. And then when thinking she's begging to call Jesus, Jesus, and the house collapsed.
Où elle est déjà?
Bonnie had just arrived in the park as Joachim was brought in, but immediately pulls out a rare commodity in Port-au-Prince these days, a working cell phone.
You calling your family?
Yeah. Do you want to say the family, she's alive?
Bonnie says she told him her family lives in Gonaive, a town far from Port-au-Prince and largely unaffected by the earthquake. She asks Bonnie to call her closest contact in Port-au-Prince, the pastor of her church. It's a call that's ultimately unsuccessful.
Yeah, but I tried to contact one of them. You see, I make a call for her, but the people he told me to call is die. He's another people to take the phone. He said the pastor is die.
Until a few minutes ago, Dennis Bonnie, Roberta Joachim, and the people who helped pull her from the rubble were all strangers. But although it's a nation of 9 million people, Haiti is something like a small town, where friendships and family connections matter, and where, especially now, nearly everyone feels a close kinship. Bonnie stays on the phone calling friends from Gonaive, asking them to spread the word to her family that Roberta Joachim, a young woman from the provinces, is alive. Greg Allen, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
While most of the attention was focused on Port-au-Prince, NPR's Jackie Northam tagged along with a search and rescue team outside the capital.
Much of the road to the city of Liaogan, about 40 miles due west of Port-au-Prince, is surprisingly smooth given the ferocity of the earthquake. But the closer you get to Liaogan, the greater the devastation. The city is very near the quake's epicenter. And as you drive into Liaogan, it seems every house, every building either collapsed or is teetering at a dangerous angle. The people in this city of 160,000 seem almost in shock. They stand in groups and gaze at the destruction. The parks in Liaogan are starting to fill with makeshift tents.
Chris, you got your back.
Members of a joint British and Icelandic search and rescue team quickly set up a command center in the middle of an empty field.
Receiving, Jeff, over.
And this is just March, receiving, over.
Your signal loud and clear.
This is the first search and rescue team to arrive in Liaogan, about 5 days after the earthquake. A reconnaissance team assessed that 80% of the city was destroyed. This team must quickly get the lay of the land. The maps don't include many of the smaller streets. And they need to prioritize what buildings to go to first. They rely on the local people for information.
There's a couple of dead bodies at the other school over there.
Do you know the last time we heard from somebody inside the building? Here?
No, there's no survivor. I don't think there's a survivor because people say there's no survivor inside of it.
This young fellow tells an Icelandic rescue worker, Magnus Harkonnerson, what he probably doesn't want to hear.
If you're looking for the survivor, I don't think we're going to find survivor around here. I don't really think so. They're all dead. I think you're a little bit late.
Yes, we are late here.
But at another nearby school, there's a whisper of hope. 40 to 50 children were in the school when its roof collapsed. Up to a dozen were pulled out alive several days ago. But there could be an air pocket. The kids might not have food or water, but some could still be alive. Members of the Icelandic search and rescue team walk over the roof, now at ground level, and set up sensitive listening devices. Then ask a local man to yell out to the children through a large hole in the roof. The listening devices are so sensitive they can pick up the sound of faint scratching, if it's quiet. That's difficult in this area. Rescue workers still can't make out if anyone is alive. But with up to 35 children under the rubble, they're not stopping. Jackhammers pound large holes into the roof and then cameras are inserted. It's a long process. The locals watch intently and stay out of the way. Among them is an aunt of one of the children under the roof, a 10-year-old named Brittany. She watches as the rescue workers bring in a search dog. But the dog shows no sign it's detected a living being under the rubble. A notice is spray-painted on the wall outside the former school, saying the building was searched and that no survivors were found. The Icelandic and British rescue team were due to search Liaogan for up to 3 days, but pull out after the first. It's clear they are too late to pull any survivors from the rubble here, and they're needed elsewhere. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Coming up, Haitians flock to the U.S. Embassy in hopes of finding a way out. and the story of one Haitian-American who chose the wrong moment for a visit to the country of his birth.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
In the aftermath of the earthquake, Haitians gathered in front of the U.S. Embassy, desperate to get flights out of their shattered country. The line seemed to grow day by day. Port-au-Prince was rife with rumors that almost any connection to the United States could win them visas. But as NPR's John Burnett reported, many were in for a disappointment.
Much of the capital has disintegrated into concrete chunks, but the gleaming white U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince stands virtually untouched. A few light fixtures came loose inside. With its own power, water, and sewage treatment, the brand new U.S. Embassy is a self-sufficient island of order in the bedlam of post-earthquake Haiti. They start lining up at the consular office here before sunrise to ask, to beg for transit out of their broken city. Jean Joseph, who's a permanent resident in the U.S., stands in line to get visas for his little brother and sister, 20 and 18, who are not residents. They live here in Haiti.
If you got like your parents, like if you got all your family in the U.S. and you got somebody, you know, represent you here in Haiti, they're going to help you. So that's
there's a rumor making its way around the capital that any Haitian with a relative in the U.S. can join his or her family. But U.S. officials say only Haitians with U.S. passports are being airlifted to the states at U.S. government expense. Lost or buried passports are not a problem. The person will still be in the U.S. database. Margalita Bellhummer is a Haitian-American living in New York City. She was here in her home country visiting when the quake hit 9 days ago. She shades her eyes from the tropical sun. The girl squatting at her feet with a threadbare sweater over her head is 8-year-old Melissa.
I'm seeking to leave with my daughter because usually where she stays, the people there are dead, the places crumble down, there's nothing left there, so I have nowhere to leave her, so I can't leave without her.
Margalita says she raised Melissa since the girl was a newborn infant, wrapped in a sheet and left on the sidewalk in front of St. Joseph's Catholic Church here. Child abandonment by destitute mothers is not uncommon in Haiti. While Bellhummer worked at her job as a security guard in New York, she paid a family to take care of Melissa. Bellhummer says she's already begun the paperwork to adopt her.
I started the adoption process, but I started it last month. But I've had her since the first day she was born.
Standing nearby her, a slim, courteous school teacher named Joseph Etienne has brought 13 members of his family with him to stand in line in the 90-degree heat under the distrustful gaze of the Marine guards. He says the Etienne family is sleeping under plantain trees since their home was pulverized. The family has no luggage with them, nothing, because they lost everything in the quake. And what do they have to convince the consular office that he should let them into the U.S.? The school teacher reaches into his pocket and pulls out two slips of paper written with names and addresses.
So he hopes with just names and addresses of in-laws in New Jersey that they'll let his family of 14 immigrate to the States.
Yeah, they're hoping when they go through the line.
Deep within the cool, soundless embassy building is the office of U.S. Ambassador Ken Merton. In the midst of the crisis, the ambassador has been sleeping on a cot in his office with his beagle Sophie taking an easy chair. The ambassador has bad news for the Etienne family.
We will tell him, unfortunately, sir, there's nothing we can do for you in this case. We are providing humanitarian aid and assistance, as well as, you know, medical assistance. And if that's what you need, we hope you can benefit from that. But we're not able to facilitate people's travel to the United States in a case like that.
After waiting hours in line, the Etiennes, Margalita Bellhummer, and hundreds of other Haitians will have to return tomorrow for an answer to their immigration pleas. A Marine guard cut the line and told them there was no way they'd make it to a consular window today.
Let's go.
We've got to move.
Guys, you got to keep going.
I can't hear you.
John Burnett, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
More than 40,000 Americans were living in Haiti when the quake struck. Many are Haitian Americans, including some who had retired to their country of birth. NPR's Corey Flintoff encountered one such man in a wrecked hillside slum on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince.
Survivors are sleeping in nearly every open space in the city.
fearful that even the buildings that withstood last week's earthquake could collapse in one of the frequent aftershocks. This is a small park on the edge of the city center where several hundred people are camping on the pavement or in the dirt. A young woman who gives her name only as Mariam sits on the curb with a cluster of other people who look worn by more than a week of living in the open amid the dust and smoke of the ruined city. She speaks through an interpreter.
I am sick. All of us are sick, and we are hungry too. There is an influenza. We've got catch cold. We are afraid. We don't know what may happen at any time.
Is it dangerous here? I mean, have you seen any shooting? Have you seen anybody stealing, looting, things like that?
Yes. Yes.
What have you seen?
This way.
Bon, moun yo ap kase ka yap ka fè ka deja k sou moun la bo isi an. Ou pa ka dormi vreman.
There are a lot of thieves. They are sneaking into people's house. They are raping ladies. We are afraid. We don't know what to do.
There's an acrid stink of excrement in the air. When asked where people go to the bathroom, Mariam points to a pair of sagging blue portable toilets a few yards away. She says the toilets are overflowing and people are forced to relieve themselves on the ground or in the streets. This could cause one of the things health workers fear most, an outbreak of disease among people who are already weakened and stressed. Food is beginning to show up for sale on the street, but few who shelter here can afford it. Across the city, in the district called Del Mar, people have stretched tarps in side streets and yards, many with bedsheet banners that say, in English, we need help, food and medicine. But some people have it a little better. The tin roof Tabernacle du Plein Evangile, the full gospel tabernacle, survived the earthquake and it's now sheltering its congregation. There are about 60 people in the church, including women tending babies and a few heavily bandaged children. Pastor Jean Nerva Mondestine says that more than 400 people come to sleep here each night, but he doesn't have food for them or medical care. He says this street is dangerous at night and the tabernacle is unguarded.
Though there is no security, but we are not afraid. We believe in God. We rely on God for our security.
Even for those who, like Mondestine's congregation, have a roof over their heads, life is overcrowded, dirty, and unhealthy. It remains to be seen whether it's even possible to move hundreds of thousands of people out of the city. But if it is, many people now on the street may see it as a chance to survive. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.